This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If Russia can retain its role as a power broker in Libya, it not only will gain permanent access to naval bases in eastern Libya, but it will likely gain continued access to some of the hydrocarbon resources in Libya and in the eastern Mediterranean.
That's Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on Russia's deployment of mercenaries to allies as part of its diplomatic strategy in Africa. Details coming up. Also, France says it will suspend joint military operations with Mali. And after 7 years, Spain reopens its embassy in Libya. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. A recent study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies revealed that Russia is combining mercenary diplomacy and disinformation campaigns to achieve its strategic goals in Africa. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Center, told VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi that mercenaries from the Wagner Group, which is closely tied to Russia's military intelligence agency, have been deployed in Libya, Central African Republic, Sudan, Mozambique, while Russian disinformation messaging is, at times, linked to broader diplomatic support to help friendly African regimes remain in power.
The mercenary groups that Russia has deployed, they're largely part of what's called the Wagner Group, run by Yevgeny Prigozhin, a close ally of Vladimir Putin. And, you know, by their nature, these are often opaque deals. So we don't know for sure all of the places that they're operating and how they're operating. But as best we can tell, we know that there are some 1,200 Wagner forces in Libya, another 1,200 in Central African Republic. Wagner has been involved in Sudan and Mozambique. And we know there have been ties in other places like Mali, Angola, Madagascar, Guinea, and other places. I should say, you know, these are mercenary deployments are usually accompanied by disinformation campaigns, and they're aimed at either undermining a constitutionally based government or to prop up a government that's friendly to Moscow. And so this is, you know, accompanied by election meddling, disparaging the processes of government in these countries and suggesting that there's a trade-off between democracy and stability that the citizens must face.
For Libya, U.S. and U.N. Security Council called repeatedly on Russia to withdraw its Wagner mercenaries from Libya. Why Russia is not complying with this call?
Russia sees Libya as a very important strategic initiative for its interest in Africa. If Russia can retain its role as a power broker in Libya, it not only will gain permanent access to naval bases in eastern Libya, but it will likely gain continued access to some of the hydrocarbon resources in Libya and in the eastern Mediterranean. It's a very strategic location for Russia, especially vis-a-vis Europe. And so it's going to take a lot of pressure before Russia is going to leave Libya. And frankly, I think Russia feels that the costs aren't that high for being there. It can ignore these UN and other international calls for it to depart. It'll do so until it faces more serious pushback.
So what are the major implications of Russian expansion in Africa for both Africa and the West?
The first implication is that when you look at the primary exports that Russia has to offer to Africa, mercenaries, arms, disinformation, election meddling, I mean, all of these are inherently destabilizing. So this is the main immediate implication for Africa. Say, in addition, you know, the propping up of unconstitutional claims on power with selected leaders is also undermining the democratic aspirations for the vast majority of Africans. And so the implication of this is a sidelining of African agency and African sovereignty. I think for the international community, the main impact is that as Russia gains more influence in Africa, We're seeing a weakening of the commitment to a rules-based order and undermining of democratic norms. You know, Russia's trying to advance the notion that there's an equivalency between democracy and authoritarian systems in Africa and globally. And so to the extent that Russia is able to do so, it plays into Moscow's advantage.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. There has been speculation that the Central African Republic has sent Russian mercenaries to its increasingly tense border with Chad, where 6 Chadians and 3 Russians were killed in fighting at a border post recently, and reports say fresh fighting has erupted. A summit today by the Economic Community of Central African States is expected to have Chad high on its agenda amid concerns that instability there could spread. France says it is going to suspend joint military operations with forces from Mali. The decision, according to the French news agency AFP, comes after Mali's military strongman, Assima Goïta, who led last year's coup, ousted the transitional president and prime minister last week. The move sparked an uproar, prompting the United States to suspend security assistance to the Malian security forces and for the African Union and the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, to suspend Mali's membership. Both Mali and France play key roles in the fight against a bloody jihadist insurgency plaguing the Sahel region. France has around 5,100 troops in the Sahel under its Barkhane operation, which spans 5 countries, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. Yesterday, French President Emmanuel Macron warned that France would pull its troops from Mali if the country lurches towards radical Islamism following the coup. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Mekelle, the capital of Ethiopia's Tigray region. Today she visited a hospital and she tells VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson the level of violence is far greater than she has seen while covering other conflicts. Here's their conversation.
So right now I'm in a hospital here and I've spent today, for the most part of the day, talking to children who have been injured in the war. It's like nothing I've ever seen. I've never seen injuries like this for children. And I've been covering wars for 10 years. I've seen a lot of injuries. For example, we saw a little girl who was 4 years old who was, her father said she was attacked with a knife on her leg by a soldier. So somebody actually attacked the child with a knife. A teenage girl, I think she's 15, was shot in the face and survived. She's blinded for life. One of her eyes is gone, but her doctors say she will recover for the most part besides this disability. And the list goes on. And the level of violence is pretty unbelievable. I've also been working in displacement camps, and there's about 200,000 displaced people in the city among about 2 million in the region. And while this city is probably the most well-served by the humanitarian community in the region, it's still severely lacking. One camp we went to, people were just hungry. There just wasn't enough food. The food was delivered daily, but many days, as it was yesterday when I was there, the food just didn't come. And there also, the camp I was at today, they said that they did have humanitarian aid because they were connected to a Catholic charity, but it was also very crowded, and they were sleeping with 30 or 40 people in every single room.
Who do the children and the medical people and the aid workers say is responsible for these injuries and the violence?
At the hospital, the medical workers and the families say that it's not in just one group. This war is between, on one side, the Tigrayan forces, TPLF, and on the other side is Ethiopian federal forces and Eritrean forces, and there's also militias associated with some of the groups. And so to blame for the extreme violence is different groups. It's not all one. Among the children I spoke to today, I heard blame laid on Ethiopian forces and Eritrean forces, as well as militias associated with Ethiopian forces.
What are the, you know, are the TPLF and the Ethiopian government making statements about, you know, what is their position on what's going on?
The Ethiopian government does acknowledge the humanitarian crisis here and has recently, you know, made an effort to put forward information about what they are doing to try to help end the humanitarian crisis, and said that Eritrean forces are actually going to leave Ethiopia. They've also made some effort to prosecute soldiers accused of abuses on civilians here. That being said, there's not a tremendous amount of information coming from Tigray at all, because so much of it's cut off. The internet is largely doesn't work here at all. There's a couple of hotels that have it in Mekelle, but that's the capital of the region. You can't expect, if there's only just two or three places in this city, that there's almost any access anywhere else. But there's not a lot of information about how the war is going to end from either side. The TPLF has also been very quiet.
That was VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch, who specializes in covering refugees and displaced people. She was speaking from Mekelle, the capital of Ethiopia's Tigray region, with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. According to a new report, the involvement of local and international private companies in corruption in Zimbabwe is vast. The 64-page document titled Cartel Power Dynamics in Zimbabwe was authored by some of the country's top researchers. It says private firms are collaborating with Zimbabwe's political elite, including President Emmerson Mnangagwa, to effectively steal billions of dollars every year. Darren Taylor has more.
The ruling ZANU-PF party says the report is nothing but lies. That isn't stopping its publisher, South African social justice activist Mark Haywood, from spreading it far and wide. He says the academics and activists who wrote and researched it published it outside Zimbabwe in fear of retribution. Haywood says it should be compulsory reading for anyone who wants to know how a government captures a country's resources and riches and condemns the majority of a nation to extreme poverty, with the help of venal private companies and individuals.
They prop up the current elite that is in power through a mutually beneficial relationship where the private part of it gets extremely wealthy and the politicians get extremely wealthy. Each scratch the other's back in order to maintain their non-competitive advantage in the economy as a means to...
The report identifies five sectors of Zimbabwe's economy that are under total control of cartels: agriculture, fuel, mining, roads, and tobacco. It says private firms overprice the inputs farmers need to grow crops, for example. In one study, cotton farmers were overcharged $142 per hectare for inputs.
It describes the modus operandi of corruption and illicit financial transactions, whether it is under invoicing on exports, whether it's illegal smuggling of tobacco, whether it's illegal smuggling of gold, whether it is the selling off of public assets to private buyers, which then...
The report says one such asset that should belong to the public, but that the government has given to the private Secunda firm, is the fuel pipeline from Beira in Mozambique to Furuka, near the town of Mutare. Secunda imports as much fuel as it wants via the conduit and charges other importers to use it. Haywood says the cartels recycle money continually, hiding investments, keeping it out of reach of the majority. Evidence of this, he says, can be found in a World Bank analysis, naming Zimbabwe as having one of the world's largest informal economies, when 90% of people lack formal jobs.
again, the evidence of how the real economy is constricted and strangled, killing jobs, killing productive employment, and forcing people into informal employment as a means to try to keep alive.
Haywood says the super-rich elites use illicit financial flows to prevent development of Zimbabwe's economy because it's in their interests to keep the poor poorer.
So anybody in Zimbabwe who thinks that this is a developing country that will slowly make progress is fooling themselves for as long as this stranglehold remains unbroken.
He's confident the report's a true reflection of what's unfolding in Zimbabwe.
I have not seen any serious attempt to refute it, to discredit it on an evidentiary basis and say, well, you say that the way it works is like this, but in fact it works like that, and here's the evidence. And, you know, to give one example, a few people have come forward and said, we're not the directors of this company, but nobody knows who the directors of particular companies are. The law that was going to require...
Haywood's concerned that as damning as some of the evidence in the report is, it won't be acted on.
I'm worried. I feel as if this report should be seriously studied. I did send it to the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission. They never acknowledged the report. It ought to be a type...
The Office of the Southern African Development Community also hasn't recognized the document, but still voices opposition to Washington's targeted sanctioning of some of the individuals and entities implicated in it. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Spain has reopened its embassy in Libya after 7 years of closure. The Associated Press reports that Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is in the Libyan capital Tripoli to reopen the embassy and show support for Libya's interim government. The Spanish Prime Minister yesterday held talks with his Libyan counterpart, Abdulhamid Dabiba, who was elected in February along with a four-member presidential council. Spain and other Western countries withdrew their diplomatic staff and closed their missions in Libya in 2014 following the escalation of violence between Islamic militias and government forces in Tripoli. But in October, a ceasefire has stopped most of the violence, and a series of senior European and American diplomats have visited oil-rich Libya to express support to the new administration. The UN Refugee Agency says at least 57 civilians were killed, including 7 children and nearly 6,000 forced to flee when their displacement sites came under attack in the Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern Ituri province on May 31st. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The armed rebel group, Allied Democratic Forces, reportedly staged multiple simultaneous attacks on displacement sites and villages near the towns of Boga and Chabi in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Witnesses say the armed men shot and attacked people with machetes, killing and wounding scores of people. They say at least 25 people were abducted and more than 70 shelters and stores set on fire. UN refugee spokesman Baba Baluch calls the latest series of atrocities committed by the ADF outrageous and heartbreaking.
In Boga town alone, 31 women, children, and men were killed. Bereaved family members told UNHCR partners that many of their relatives were burnt alive in their houses.
More than 5 million people have been uprooted by insecurity and violence in the DRC, 1.7 million in Ituri province alone. Baluch says security in the region must be scaled up to protect the lives of civilians, many of whom have been attacked and forced to flee many times.
We have seen in the past where there is security presence, that the number of attacks go down, but understanding how these displacement sites are, which are scattered all around the Ituri province, many of them are spontaneous. So people go through horrendous atrocities at the hand of the armed group.
The UN spokesman says thousands of people fled the attacks with virtually nothing but the clothes on their backs. Many are sleeping out in the open in the bush. He says people are in desperate need of assistance. Unfortunately, insecurity, he notes, is hampering humanitarian work. He says the office of one of the UNHCR's partner agencies recently was looted, depriving thousands of crucial aid. Moreover, security concerns have forced health centers in Bunia, the capital of Ituri, to evacuate their staff and temporarily suspend activities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. A study reveals that Russia is combining mercenary diplomacy and disinformation campaigns to achieve its strategic goals in Africa. France says it will suspend joint military operations with Mali. And after 7 years, Spain reopens its embassy in Libya. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Chaos at the Pan-African Parliament this week lifted the curtain on the power struggles on the continent. VOA's Anita Powell tries to break it down, reporting from Johannesburg.
A male parliamentarian kicked a female colleague from South Africa. A female parliamentarian from Zimbabwe left nursing a sore hand after a scuffle with three male colleagues. These were amongst the chaotic scenes for 3 days in a row at the Pan-African Parliament in Midrand, South Africa. From its establishment in 2004, the Pan-African Parliament has been led by Francophone countries taking advantage of their numbers on votes. But English-speaking countries, largely in the south and some in the north, said they could not take it anymore and demanded rotational chances for the presidency. Zimbabwean parliamentarian Barbara Rhodes led them.
I do not agree with going ahead with these elections unless we observe and we follow what has been written to the clerk of this parliament. I submit.
But those from the Francophone countries were having none of it, leading to outbursts, insult, and physical manhandling. Roger Nkodo Dang from Cameroon is the outgoing president.
If you want to apply rotation, we'll start long time ago. I have been elected twice. Southern region bring the candidate. Northern region bring the candidate. I beat them the election.
But South African parliamentarian Pemima Jodina strongly objected.
You people from the Francophones, you're not honest.
After 3 days, the election was called off and the sitting suspended in an effort to cool tempers. South Africa's ruling African National Congress was the first to condemn the chaos and animosity. Pule Mabe is the spokesperson of the ANC.
The scenes we saw there are not commensurate with the kind of a pact that we ought to achieve of uniting the rest of Africa's people.
Mabuto Mabena, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Communist Party, says the animosity is evidence of long-held hatred between some Africans.
As the Zimbabwe Communist Party, we reject this division based along the lines of the former colonizers, the French and the English. We must build unity within the African continent.
David Monyaye is an African studies expert at the University of Johannesburg.
We see it reflecting the weaknesses of the entire AU structure, and they somehow reflecting their parties and governments. And it speaks of the nature and character of governments that are there on the African continent.
Set up in 2004, the Pan-African Parliament is an organ of the African Union. It only has advisory and consultative powers. There are now calls for the African Union to intervene and save the continent from further embarrassment. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.